Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio.
This is AppSats Radio, help for partners after sexual betrayal. We talk about it here.
Betrayal trauma.
We are AppSats certified clinical partner specialists and coaches who have been trained to help navigate you through this crisis. There is nothing we won't talk about.
Sometimes listeners want to know about triggers.
I'm dealing with the aftermath of my husband's affairs, and he still works the same job that he did when he was acting out. It's a job that allows him to hide his goings-on and one that he stated was a previous trigger for his acting out. The whole 16 and a half years we've been together, he's acted out. In the beginning, what I thought it was just pornography. It ended up being, I found out 2.5 years ago, he had been with multiple prostitutes. I only found out a very small portion of that until about a month ago. How do you cope with all of that when you still have to deal with unavoidable triggers?
Well, of course you would feel traumatized by hearing all that information. And I got to tell you, Stephanie, that's a staggered disclosure. That's finding out little bits and pieces about your husband's behavior throughout a time period, making you feel insecure, unsure, and unsafe. So what we got to do is set up a situation whereby you get with a specialist to do a formal disclosure so you can hear everything at one time in a safe environment.
All right. Welcome to Betrayal Recovery Radio, and I am so happy to be talking with you today. You know, this is the AppSats Radio program that helps you to get through the darkest and the toughest times of your life. And we always give tips and tools and all sorts of things that will help you navigate through the horror. And I really want to know what you're dealing with. So if you have specific issues that you'd like me to talk about, I've got one listener who has sent me over 20 suggestions with even some contact people. I would love to know it. So send it to Carol@CarolTheCoach.com. Because it's all about empowering you to be able to know your strengths, to get you through the discovery. If you're a partner that's, gosh, been dealing with this for 2 or 3 years, then maybe we need to get you through the grief and mourning stages of partner betrayal, because, you know, I say there's 3 stages. This is an AppSats model. So it's really not me that says it, although I'm going to tell you right now, this is how AppSats works. AppSats believes that you need to find safety and stabilization first. And then when you get back on your feet, you need to grieve and mourn the loss of what you had. And then, as you might imagine, you have to be able to find yourself again, really develop who you are. And that actually is kind of a fun process. That third phase may mean that you are doing better than you ever thought you could have. Maybe even better than before you even knew that your spouse was an addict. So that's the good news. And I love that we have opportunities to teach you how to get to that place. As a matter of fact, I'm just wrapping up a very special workbook for partners, and it goes through those 3 stages, and it has exercises that help to work through safety and stabilization, as well as, I call it, anger, grief, and mourning. And then the restoration phase is the phase that I call post-traumatic stress. So I'm going to share with you one of the exercises. This is your opportunity to learn about something that nobody else in the world has, it is really a chance to look at your life from partner betrayal and then look at your life either before the partner betrayal or maybe how you would like it to be. So the truth of the matter is I don't want you defined as a partner. I mean, you are a partner, and this is Partner Recovery Radio, but you're so much more than that. And so we've got to get you to a place where you really can access your own power. And one of the ways we do that is in the what is a partner versus what is a woman exercise. Now, you know, I know this is maybe hard to envision. You probably need the workbook right in front of you. But I'm going to ask you, when you think about yourself as a partner, whether discovery was just at the beginning of the summer or the spring, or maybe again, like I indicated, you first found out that your husband had problematic compulsive sexual behavior 4 years ago. But if you were going to describe the words that describe a partner, and try to access both the positive and the negative, I would love to know what those words are. So if you would, think about 10 words so that you can, in actuality, identify kind of a composite of who you are as a partner. And you never know. It may be that those words are things like hypervigilant, angry, hurt, sad. Okay, now this might be the time to come up with some positive words. And that would be diligent, loving, tenacious, maybe intelligent. And then what might be some other words that would describe you as a partner? Traumatized, wounded, secure, suspicious. And then what would some more positive words be? Spiritual. Dutiful. Would you ever say brilliant? Or even powerful? So you write down those words, and then you fill out the statement. And there's actually three of them. And they go like this. As a woman, I am. As a woman, I am not. I'm sorry, as a partner I am, and as a partner I am not, and as a recovering partner I want to be. Okay, that meets you right where you're at. So you'd use the words you picked, and you'd fill in what fits the best. And you can't use two words, you only can use one. As a partner I am, as a partner I am not, as a recovering partner, I want to be. So maybe that would look like, well, as a partner, I am hypervigilant, meaning I'm always out of my window of tolerance. I'm always looking for the shoe to fall. I'm always making sure that I'm safe. And as a partner, I am not. Maybe that would be, as a partner, I'm not secure right now. My whole world is falling apart. So as a partner, I am not secure. And then as a recovering partner, I want to be. Maybe that word is strong. Maybe you want to feel safe, secure. Maybe you want to feel empowered. I want to be empowered. I want to be intuitive. I want to be more spiritual. See, you get the drift, right? So that's as a partner. Now do the same exercise and think about if partner betrayal had never happened to you. how would your life be different? What words would best describe who you are as a woman? Maybe that woman was a woman in college, a woman before marriage. Maybe it was when she got married. Maybe it was as a mother. But what words would best describe you as a woman? Remember, not as a partner. So, again, the positive words might be diligent or practical or sexual or persistent or spiritual or giving or friendly. You get the drift. So you circle those words. And then you come up with them and, you know, you pick your top five and then think about some qualities, some personality strengths, and maybe even some personality identifiers that aren't positive. Like, well, I've always been depressed. As a woman, I'm depressed. Or I'm hypersensitive. Or I'm stubborn. Or I'm codependent. You think about those not so nice words. And then you do the same exercise, but instead of saying as a partner, you say, as a woman, I am. As a woman, I am not. As a woman, I want to be. So if I were going to fill in this exercise, because I've done it a million times, okay, maybe not a million, but thousands of times, because my colleague and I that wrote this book, we run over 2,000 women's groups. And so I would put, as a woman, I am tenacious, because I am. I am tenacious. And as a woman, I am not. And I would put, as a woman, I am not soft-spoken. I was thinking about this the other day, that I've got my taxes came back. I owe $20,000 more. And I am talking to my accountant, and I am on her. I am like saying, call me back. I need to know what's going on and how this could have happened. And, you know, some people might even call that bitchy, but I call it assertive. I say, I'm going to be clear and direct about what I think, feel, and need. Okay. So, as a woman, I want to be, and if I looked at my goals one more time, and thought about, you know, what else do I want to be? And I would say that if there's an issue I have, it's the fact that there's always a cloud over me that's afraid I'm going to be punished. Not parentally punished, but punished for my assertiveness. Somebody might call me the B word, or somebody might not want to be my friend, or I might be punished because I make a recommendation and someone says, that was not your recommendation to make. So that's, as a woman, I want to feel more confident, and that would mean about my choices. Okay, I'm giving you that homework, because next, I'm going to be talking with Artie Chittablum, and she is all the way in Thailand, and she is just working diligently for partners, and she's what I would call a boundary expert. Seriously, she is a boundary expert, and what I mean by that is that she has developed some tools that I believe can really help you in not only determining your boundaries, but also in determining your consequences. And I know for a fact that it is very difficult to know how to set up boundaries and also to be able to know the consequences to deal with if somebody doesn't follow through with the boundary setting, doesn't respect that. And so I am just so happy to have Artie here. Artie, welcome to Betrayal Recovery Radio. How are you?
Thank you so much. I just wanted to kind of mention I'm in Singapore, not Thailand, but it's all on the east side of the globe.
Oh, my goodness. You know what? Okay, this is really bad. I thought Singapore was Thailand.
Oh, well, here we have a geography lesson. Then Singapore is this little red dot somewhere in the Indian Ocean. Not even. It's called the Singapore Straits. So, you know, down south. And it's just a small little city-state country, like Monaco, if you would.
Got it. And so what time is it in Singapore?
It is 2:15 in the morning, the morning of 21st August. So, hey, it's time travel.
Wow. Okay, I so appreciate you coming on at 2:15 in the morning to talk about boundaries. That's what I mean. You're an APSATS grad. You know
yes.
what it's like to want partners to get healthy. And you heard me call you the boundary expert because I really do believe you. Yeah, you've made it your, if you will, mission to help partners figure out how to develop better boundaries. So can you tell me a little bit about how would you move from the theoretical perspective of boundaries and move to, you know, kind of the putting it into practice with spouses?
Yeah. Well, thank you, Carol. That's a great question, and I get that asked a lot. But, you know, I do think there are, you know, other boundary experts there. I think what I like to do is, like, you know, Vicky Tidwell-Palmer and even Henry Cloud's book on boundaries is excellent. So as Barbara Steffens keeps saying, we develop on the shoulders of giants. I think these guys have done amazing work. But I think what I like to do and bring into play is exactly that, moving it from the book to practical day-to-day, everyday spaces. And one of the key differentiators that I find that really helps partners in understanding a boundary, how to make it into a practical tool, is to first understand really deeply why a particular boundary is there in the first place. So when they start talking about putting down boundaries or what does it look like, it goes back to the safety needs. I firmly believe, like pretty much everybody in the APSAT believes, that boundaries are safety requirements. They aren't meant to create control. They aren't meant to, you know, put people in cages or boxes, but they are meant to create safety for a betrayed partner because, going back to the stage one, safety and stabilization, when we hear about a betrayal or when we find out about a betrayal, the person's whole world comes crashing down. There are no two ways about it. You don't know what's up, which side is up, which side is down. You don't know where the world you're standing on, the ground under you, is it real or not. So there's so many things that just, it's like a bomb goes off and everything is chaos, right? So to be able to get them to figure out what they need, the questions I ask is actually based on the impact letter that they would write after the disclosure and after they've understood where they have been. Every boundary that is there, and the impact letter and boundaries come pretty much after that, it is an understanding of where were they feeling completely unsafe and where do they need to put their safety down. And you said something about, you know, the biggest problem is how do we hold it when things don't go our way, when there's a breach or what happens? Well, the first thing I get asked at that point in time is, tell me, what has changed since the time you put down the boundary? Has anything changed? Has there been movement forward? Has there been healing towards that particular safety concern? Have there been, you know, built up towards, you know, like bricks have been laid. There's been, you can remove the guardrail a little bit because, you know, that's no more a danger zone. Has anything like that happened? If the answer to that is no, then the boundaries need to remain because they are still a safety concern. But if the answer to that is yes, then we need to understand the boundaries is, you know, like movable. It is not like, you know, movable in that avant-garde, nonchalant kind of way, but in a flexible way where the document can be reviewed and discussed and constantly evolved. The one thing that a lot of partners feel very stuck with is if they've written the boundary and they put down the consequences for it, then they're kind of boxed into it, right? Like they have to follow through in that particular way. But I like to look at boundary as a living, breathing document, which evolves as a couple evolves, which evolves as, you know, of course, there are the basic tenets that they both have shared values and they stand on that. Maybe it's, you know, like no third-party contact or maybe it's like no pornography, whichever they have decided are strong tenets, which cannot move. But if there are other... other safety concerns that over a period of time have become naturally evolved into more connecting conversations, like the check-ins have become more of a connecting conversation, then they don't need to be really on the boundary list. But if they are still not happening in a way that creates safety for the partner, then the discussion continues. But the boundaries are always discussed and kept in the front for people to know we're doing this not because we're trying to control anybody, but we're doing this because they are safety concerns. And as long as these concerns remain, the boundary remains. So that's one of the things I like to work with partners very, very closely on. Tell me why the boundary is there. What has happened on that particular thing that the boundary exists? And does this boundary help in creating safety around that? So that's one of the ways I look at boundaries.
And so, Artie, if you were working with a couple where he continues to have slips, he continues to buy more iPads, get second and third phones, he appears to be working his program, but she keeps discovering that he's acting out, and he's saying, okay, well, I am acting out, but I'm not acting out with deal-breaking behaviors. You know, he
right.
believes that since he isn't with a prostitute and he's not with an affair partner and he's not sleeping with a man, that
right.
these are small issues.
Yes.
What kind of boundaries might you suggest that she deal with? Because one of the things she's doing right now is
mm-hmm.
She said, I don't feel safe to sleep in the same bed with you. I feel like I've got to be with somebody and trust them, and I don't trust you right now, so of course I don't want to sleep with you.
Right.
What do you think? Is that a good boundary?
That's an excellent boundary, Carol. In fact, one of the things that I talk a lot about, especially which gives power to boundaries, is consequences that can be brought to play. And what the idea that I work with is a concept called layered consequences, which basically means that from increasing therapy to all our legal separation and divorce, everything is on the table. So we try to, you know, course correct along the way through, you know, like moving out of the bedroom, marital bedroom, moving out of the house for a couple of weeks, you know, trying therapeutic separation for a couple of weeks, and still working along, you know, if the behavior can be rectified. But going back to, he is continuing to act out under what he has deemed as safe behavior and not her, that in itself is a problem we'd have to address. Because he is still, unfortunately, maybe not acting out with a third party, but definitely acting out emotionally in that sense. So we can't call it being really in recovery or in sobriety. And working with a partner to help her see that it's if she's not feeling safe and he's continuing to engage in behavior that's keeping her hypervigilant or is kind of not on her safe terms, then that's a bigger issue than just keeping it on consequences. Because we have to talk about the fact that he is blatantly not working with the shared value systems that the couple might have engaged in when they got together. So the other concept that I like to bring in is a concept called informed consent or informed choice. Now this has, I think the boundaries are based on this as well to a certain extent, because when a partner finds out that her, spouse has been acting out, the first thing that comes to my mind is there's been, the behavior has been happening without her consent and without her knowledge, obviously. So she wasn't given the basic courtesy of making an informed choice whether she wants to be in a relationship, whereby this is the definition of safety or this is the definition of connectedness or fidelity, whatever the promises and vows they made to each other at the time of coming together, the commitments that were given. The betrayal is of that. So if the person is consistently, constantly acting in a way that remains unsafe for the partner, I think we have to start talking to the partner about the safety needs that aren't being met. And if moving out of the bedroom is not helping her, then we have to ask her, what does she need? What would make her feel a little bit more safer in this space? What feels truer to her system? Like, our body will give us cues all the time. So if you're not feeling safe and your tummy is rumbling all the time, you're having, anxiety attacks, then clearly what he's offering as a safe option, quote unquote, is not safe for her. They're not working from a shared value system towards the building of a coupleship. So that becomes a bigger question to ask, and then base your notion of boundaries from that level of safety and shared and value. This is one of the things Dan Drake spoke once on a meeting that we were together on, when he spoke about with the value. If your boundaries are value-driven, you're able to understand and defend them better because they are safety-seeking and value-driven. So where are the shared values?
Yes, that makes total sense. And that's what we're always talking to addicts about. We're saying, look, for the first one, the really five, but I say sometimes not to be discouraging, for the first 1 to 3 years, you really have to do whatever it takes to make her feel safe. And even if you personally don't accept, don't believe that what you're doing is a big deal, if it's a big deal to her and it makes a difference in your relationship and it creates a feeling of unsafety, then you really need to acquiesce and do it for her. It's kind of that help her heal model of what can you do to help her heal. And so, again, that means that we look at what do you think as the addict, and then what are you willing to give? Is there a willingness to do this for her because she needs it to feel safe? And boundaries really are that mechanism to help you feel safe, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, that's something that I think I believe from the core of my being, that boundaries are not meant to control but to empower the partner. It's the opposite of control. Empowerment is internal, control is external. So the boundaries are there to keep you safe and make empowered choices for yourself towards safety and towards, growth. You talked about the third stage just before we started about growth. These become the foundations of your growth as you move forward, that you were able to hold these boundaries and they were true to your value system. And one of the things that as boundaries go, they are going to be pushed. They're going to be kind of tested, if you would. And I've had partners have that put on them so many times. And the best thing that helps them is the two questions that I ask is, how does this function with your value system? Does this boundary help you come closer in living your values? You know, your awareness in action. How does that help? And the second question is, you know, has anything changed since you asked of this boundary? Because obviously this boundary came about because you felt unsafe about something. Let's take the example that you just gave. You've bought 2-3 phones. You've bought I don't know how many iPads. Obviously, this is not a behavior that encourages trust, or it still shows that there is a, you know, you want to have a level of secrecy towards a certain behavior of your, you know, life or something, which is not a safe feeling for a partner. So if that continues to happen, then we cannot bring down the boundary, or I don't want to call it bring down or bring up, but we cannot let go of the boundary because it's still a safety concern that this person is keeping a part of their life hidden. And we can't access it, and we're not able to really get into a connected, intimate space with our coupleship, which basically keeps us in an unsafe zone.
Yeah, very well put. And so these different layers that you were referencing before,
mm-hmm.
does that come theoretically from somebody specifically, or is that an artism?
I've been working with it for a while. I mean, I'll be happy to be corrected to see if somebody else has done it. I'm sure people might have done it. But for my perspective, I've kind of, you know, worked this part out by myself for putting these steps down. I couldn't find it. I didn't find it in any reference material for me. But the concept of layered consequences came primarily for me when I saw clients feeling boxed in by a particular consequence that they might have put maybe 6-8 months down the line and feeling differently about that right now. And, you know, kind of feeling, well, if I'm going to expect him to be authentic and honest, I got to follow through, but my heart's really not in it right now because we've come so far ahead as a couple. And I like to actually put that also in place because we talk a lot about, you know, the period of active recovery when things are stage one and stage two, right? When things are a little tough and struggling with finding your feet, putting things down. But it's also that we want to make space for a trajectory of recovery, a post-traumatic growth space, as you were talking about. We want to make space for that. We want to start having, you know, a roadmap, if you would, to what that would look like. And I think layered consequences helps a little bit in that because then it says, okay, depending on where you are and hoping that you are in a better direction, you can choose from these various consequences. Like, you know, it can be anything from increasing therapy, both individual, couple, increasing group work, increasing 12-step work, you know, for those particular 3-4 weeks. And sometimes the problem will resolve just with that. Like you just gave an example of, you know, a partner not be, maybe a recovering addict not being in sync with a partner's needs. And you then, if I say, okay, please attend this help her heal course and come back. So you've increased the therapeutic input and that might solve the issue because the empathy comes in and they've kind of got what they really needed to go. So we don't need to bring in a whole bunch of, you know, other consequences at all. But if that doesn't solve an issue, then you have the option of asking them, okay, you know what, we're still struggling with this particular issue. Maybe we need some space. So you move out of the bedroom for a little while, but you increase therapy and you hope that the combination of those two would sort the breach or the issue out. If that doesn't work, then another option that might be available is maybe moving out for a short period of time or maybe moving out or like a therapeutic separation where you're still doing couple work, but maybe you're separated and you're trying to see if this could work. And if all else fails, then you go in for, you know, a legal separation or divorce. Or if you feel that the trauma is ongoing, the person's not in good recovery, then you might want to directly go to either a therapeutic separation or legal separation and divorce. It depends on where you are as an individual and as a couple in recovery. So when you give these options, the boundaries also have a lot of roots and teeth to them, because you're not boxing yourself up. And it moves you from an all or a nothing space to we have options in between, which strengthens boundaries, I find. And in practical use, my clients have also given feedback that it really empowers them and not makes them feel like they have to choose in a moment of extreme duress or distress or trauma to kind of have to live with it, you know. So I found this helped them.
Well, absolutely. I would 100% agree. And I like the fact that you distinguished what's the difference between empowerment and control, because I know that at times addicts can feel as if it's a control issue. And in reality, it is just a woman deciding, what do I need to feel safe and what am I going to do if that boundary is violated? And
absolutely.
And it does. It really can empower them. Now, you have many a tool that works on empowerment. Can you explain what ICER is?
Oh, wow. Okay. Yes. So this is, again, a tool that I'm sure other people might have thought of it, but it kind of came as an antidote to gaslighting and DARVO in a particular moment of need, if you would. And the idea behind that is, again, to empower partners to stay true to their boundaries, to help them feel more grounded. Because a lot of times we hear partners struggling with calling their boundaries, primarily because they are, you know, there's a lot of dysfunctionality, not wanting to go into a lot of that. But gaslighting and DARVO is something we see happen a lot. So I'm assuming, you know, at this point, we all understand gaslighting and DARVO, but I kind of look at it more like an internal explosion that happens for a partner when there's constant gaslighting, that your internal reality is shaken. It's like a bomb that goes off within you, okay, where you can't trust your own gut. There's manipulation, there's years and years and years of this, and you're kind of, you know, questioning your own sanity. Is this right? Is this wrong? And then constantly being told, no, you're actually wrong. You're over, you know, reacting to this. This isn't that bad. And your gut's going all like, no, but that's horrible. So you have this multitude of things happening to you. So the one visual that came to mind is there's an explosion going on inside you. You need something to really cool it down and ground you. And hence the concept of ICER came to my brain. And the idea is it's ICE, or ICE, which basically stands for Identify, Call Out, Express. The idea, again, is when we identify something, we ground ourselves in a reality, which is very, very, very important. Because otherwise, we continue to perpetuate that, unbeknownst to ourselves, of course, perpetuate that cycle of toxicity and craziness, which is very difficult to understand under any circumstances, leave alone when you are in the midst of an emotional turmoil. So you identify, and that actually, the first I is an internal process as well, so you can look at it as an I to an I. And it is the first identification that happens within you. It's a gut that says, ooh, that feels wrong. It's like the butterflies in your stomach, your breath catching a minute, or whatever it is, the body gives you that moment of cue saying, I don't feel good about what just happened. So you identify that, and you learn not to ignore it. You kind of say, you pause with it. You say, that's what's happening. I'm just feeling that whatever happened right now is not okay with me. You call out and you actually put that fact that you have observed out there, because a lot of times partners have stopped calling things out because they've been told that what they're thinking, what they're seeing, what they're feeling is all wrong. That's not what it is. But here in recovery, we start saying, just call out, just say what happened, just factually, what did you see? So you just call out the event or the situation as you feel it, and E is you express how you felt about it. So you're kind of giving, like, one of my clients call it a cheat sheet to ground our partner in a moment of chaos, and you express that. E is for expression of your emotional feelings at that time. You might not get it all. You might not be able to say, I'm feeling, like, extremely, you know, in a succinct kind of manner that this is what I'm feeling. You might be a little all over the place saying, I'm feeling triggered. I'm feeling, you know, angry about this. I'm feeling whatever you're feeling, say it, because you're entitled and your feelings are true, and we validate that feeling. You have to acknowledge it for yourself first. You've got to put the reality out there. And then there's a big hyphen, which is really, really important. Once you have identified, once you've called out, once you have emotionally expressed how you're feeling, you take a pause where you breathe. And here I cannot emphasize enough what good breathing work how important good breathing work is to trauma recovery. And you really get into that calm, as much as possible, a grounded state of being present with yourself. And then you respond by either rejecting, saying, sorry, this is not on my side, this is on your side. You're trying to put something on me, which is not okay. Or you respond by saying, we need to take this to therapy, or we need to kind of, you know, do this differently. And you come an involved participant in your recovery. You're no more passive. You have the choice to use your intellect, your body intelligence, your PQ, your EQ, and your behavioral aspects to not be a silent spectator when gaslighting or DARGO is happening. That's how we end the cycle. So ISA is a tool to help partners break the cycle of gaslighting, DARGO, and any other manipulation that might have been going on for years. And at moments in good recovery, actually, when a partner has used ISA, I've gotten the feedback that the recovering addict actually paused and told the partner, I'm sorry, I never realized that. Thank you for pointing it out. And that, I guess, is an empowering tool for both ways. Because sometimes addicts are also stuck in their cycle, even unbeknownst to them. So partners can be active participants in their own recovery, but also in their coupleship's recovery.
Yeah, I absolutely love that, and that is so simple and easy for people to understand and to remind themselves. And I agree, Artie, one of the best ways to ground and resource is through your own breathing. If you listen and experience your breathing, it absolutely grounds and resources you immediately.
I couldn't agree more. In fact, just on the concept of breathing, I actually started a breathing session for 15 minutes a day, Monday through Friday, free of cost for anybody who would be interested. I mean, I have obviously my clients who are partners, but other clients as well, because I'm a clinician first. Whoever is interested in kind of working a breathing ritual, if you'd like, or a rhythm in their life, because we lead such busy lives, we don't pay attention to our breath as much. But there is so much research and studies that tells us that just sitting quietly and breathing, focusing on your breath, and I use pranayama breathing from the yoga part of my Indian heritage.
Mm-hmm.
We do that for 15 minutes every day, Monday through Friday. I do it continuously for 4 weeks, and then I take a break. And since it's free of cost, anybody's welcome. I never know how many people are going to join in. Sometimes it's just one person, but I've committed to sit and work on it. So I'm sitting there every day. It's actually 9 to 9:15 Singapore time in the night. So I think that would be 9 to 9:15 morning, your time. But the feedback has been phenomenal because I started it just for one client at one point because I could see that, you know, there were trigger levels that were high and reactivity that was really high. And since I was sitting for one client, I said, listen, it's open to all. Whoever wants to join in, here's the Zoom link. Just come in if you think it'd be helpful. And it's kind of become a thing for the last couple of months now. But it really helps clients. In, you know, I use about 3-4 different kinds of breath work. And it really helps clients, at least what the feedback I get, to learn to pause. And that pause is so important to break us out from what you were saying before, the window of tolerance, right? We need to be able to have a little bit wider window of tolerance to deal with all that's happening. And it's really helped with that.
Well, and so, obviously, you have offered our listening audience, although remember, she's 10 hours ahead, but you are offering the partners an opportunity to breathe with you?
Yes. So they come online, and, you know, it's only my video and my audio is on, like in a Zoom session, and everybody else's video and audio is switched off. I do like to talk to them at least once, just to kind of give them a brief on, so, you know, when if somebody's interested, they can kind of write to me, and I, if they're not my clients already, like if they're already my clients, they know me, and we don't need to do that. But if there's somebody who's just coming into the breathing, they're most welcome. If anybody's listening and would like to join in, please feel free to reach out. And I explain to them what we do, and I encourage them to keep their video switched off, their audio switched off, and any, you know, like pictures or full names on the display that might come on when the video is off. I encourage them to keep those identifying markers out to just help them with their confidentiality. And nobody knows who's who except me, because I know who you are. And we just spend 15 minutes a day together, breathing, hopefully, because I can't see them.
Well, excellent. And so they, how could they put that on their calendar and remind themselves that, you know, the time you meet is when?
So this is on Singapore time, right? So mm-hmm. It is 9 p.m. to 9:15 p.m. Singapore time, Monday through Friday. It goes on for about 4 weeks like that, and then I take a break for a week, and then we start again. So it's something like that that I've kind of put on myself for now. It's working for now, and I'll let you know if it changes. But that's what we're doing for now. And, yeah, they could – I think I'm 12 hours ahead of you, Carol, because
yep.
It's like 2:45 your time in the afternoon, and I'm about in the morning.
Yes, exactly.
So exactly 12 hours ahead. So they can kind of, you know, calculate that if they were interested. I could send out my email address to them if they would like to write in, and I could, you know, speak to them and fix it up if they were so interested.
Oh, I love that. And yes, we'd love to take you on with that. So they can email you, and your email address is?
It's RC, that's AA Alpha Alpha Roger Tango India, AARTI 28 at hotmail.com.
Very good. Excellent. And so I do think we have a minute to talk about familiarity versus functionality, and that that is a concept that you use in looking at long-term dysfunctional patterns that are occurring between spouses. So can you share a little bit about that?
Yes, and this is a concept that it's very, very, very dear to me. So you said we have about a minute, so I'll try to keep it.
You actually have 3 minutes.
Okay, so keep it as succinct as I possibly can. The notion of, again, familiarity versus functionality came about because when we see partners or even, you know, relationships in distress as in general, this thing, and as we can imagine, when where there's addiction present, there's dysfunctionality. These relationships have been usually long-term, and they have had their own patterns that get set up. They have their own norms, quote-unquote, that get set up. And a lot of times, until and unless there is a discovery or a disclosure, all these other, what I like to call subtle effects, sometimes not so subtle because sometimes we have, violent outbursts and stuff, which partners then just assign to being, oh, well, this is just who he is, or this is just how our relationship is. We are unique in that way. So there are a lot of socially acceptable terminologies that go into justifying, rationalizing, or even put, and this is all internal, so self-justifying, self-rationalizing of a behavior that might feel off to you. And that happens over a period of time, and that behavior becomes familiar, and slowly and slowly, like it's like having a little bit of a chipping away effect on who you thought you were. And this actually, to me, goes back to what you were talking about, let this not define you, because a lot of times I hear partners turn around after about 10 years and they've had this kind of like, I've lost myself. I don't remember who I was before all this started. So there is the concept of what is familiar within a relationship becomes the norm, even if it is not something that is functional. And a lot of times it is functionality that becomes familiar. And partners, little by little, keep normalizing. And this is also because our brain wants to maintain a status quo. So there is a neurochemical need to kind of not stay in a stress zone. So you keep saying, well, that's okay. It's just this little thing. Or it's just, oh, this is who he is. Oh, he kind of goes away into his zone. He needs his me time. You have a lot of those, usually you would not have accepted behaviors, but you kind of normalize that. And that becomes familiar, but it is dysfunctional. When we start looking at changing in recovery, we look at shifting that paradigm from familiar to functional. And at that time, in the beginning, the functional feels extremely unfamiliar. It feels like you're pulling teeth sometimes because you've not done that in a while. You haven't claimed what feels right for you in a while. And the work is to stay with the functional till it becomes familiar. So we're moving from functional or from familiar, which was dysfunctional, to functional, which is unfamiliar, till the time functional becomes familiar. I mean, the analogy that comes to my mind is kind of like we're changing, learning to drive shifts. I don't know how I learned to drive shifts. I don't know about you, when I learned driving. And it was really difficult to find the right gas and clutch ratio to stay in gear properly without making the car jump everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that became familiar after a point. That functional became familiar with practice, with understanding. And soon, when it became really, really familiar, the functionality, we went into automatic transmission. We don't even know when the gears change anymore. And that is where I see true growth going for the coupleship, where functionality becomes familiarity, and we move away from the dysfunctionality overall.
Well, I love that explanation. It makes a lot of sense. And I've got to say, obviously you made boundaries very understandable. We now understand why consequences are so important and why layered consequences make the most sense too. So, Artie, I can't thank you enough. And I want to tell my listening audience, you know what I'm probably going to say because I tell everybody. Artie is the reason I wrote the empathy book. I was supervising her with a group of AFSAT trainees, and I said, I've been working on this book, and it's just kind of difficult. And she goes, oh, you've got to do it, and you've got to do it quick. And so, Artie, I want to thank you so much for being the inspiration for that book.
Oh.
And honestly, you're doing great things.
Thank you so much for having me, Carol. And you know what? That book is so amazing. I mean, thank you for for doing this for partners and actually for the coupleship as a whole. A lot of addicts get so much out of it, recovering addicts who really want to change, who really find themselves stuck. So it's a gift that gives to both. So thank you so much for doing it. You're too kind. I mean, it was my desperation that I was pushing you to get it out because we so sorely lack good resources in this space. I keep saying we're still in that time of, Barbara said that, right? You're pioneers, right?
Right.
Still kind of wading through the waters and trying to pick things, trying to create things and make things happen. So thank you so much. This really helped. I bought that immediately. It's in my office, that book. And just to the listeners, it is such a wonderful tool to start the dialogue of empathy. And, you know, if an addict is in good recovery, it's such a joy to watch them transform through the help of that book, I have to say. So thank you, Carol.
Well, you're welcome. And I can feel a book in you, too. So you keep us posted. Let us know how you're doing. And we'll always take tips and tools from you, Artie, all the way.
Thank you so much for having me.
I wish you could see her. She is, like, totally dressed up, and it's 2 in the morning. Thank you, Artie.
Thank you, guys. Thank you so much, Carol. Thank you for having me.
All right. You take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So, again, Artie Chitterbaum, and she is all the way from Singapore. I will not forget that again. Not Thailand, it's Singapore. Listen, I hope you'll do my exercise. I hope you'll practice your boundaries, and I hope you stay safe and practice that breathing this week. We'll see you next week for Betrayal Recovery Radio. And as I say at the end of every show, there'll only be one of you at all times, so fearlessly have the courage to be yourself.
For more information, go to APSATS.org, the Association of Partners of Sex Addicts Trauma Specialists, to find a professional in your area who is trained to help you after sexual betrayal.